here we go with issue six of the podcast, the comics podcast. People will be wondering why they've skipped straight from issue four to issue six, but they're going to have to keep wondering because it's a secret. Why have we skipped issue five, Paul?
It was impounded in customs for questionable content.
And what happened to issue five, Jeff?
I blame Kelly.
this happens to me a lot. And had we not gone with the video podcast for that one issue, we probably would have been able to get away with it. And also, Paul, I'm really sorry about the visual trauma I caused for you.
I didn't know an eyeball could get bruised.
Who knew that the North Koreans were so, so easily offended? I just don't understand.
To be fair, it really was cold in the room, all right?
Yeah.
Be fair, who knew that the North Koreans could point a nuke at Sirencester so well?
Oh, you know what? When they really get the hump, they're so threatening. Obviously for myself, I'd have published, but there's 22,000 people
living. I'd like to point
here.
Out you said hump. That was awesome.
So, Kelly, is there any particular reason why issue five was impounded?
Current legal action prevents me from commenting on the status of issue five.
So, issue six of the British Tech Comics podcast. If you find issue five in a comic store anywhere, I suggest you buy a copy and keep it under the bed. Read it only at night by torchlight.
And considering some of the visuals in there, having it near your bed is totally appropriate.
Absolutely.
Oh, my God. Who just handed me a restraining order? What the hell?
Absolutely. I tell you what, you're going to polybag that, baby.
Excuse me. I would just like... I'd like to read an official statement from Ewan in the British Tech Network. It reads as follows. BTN would like to state that there is no issue 5. There was never an issue 5. There never will be an issue 5. All items mentioned and people insulted in issue 5 do not exist.
Yep.
Ewan's
already in your mail.
So, issue 6 of the BTN Comics podcast. It's the crew from both sides of the Atlantic. It is Jeff Gamut. Hello, Jeff.
How's it going?
It's going absolutely in a flat-out panic. I turned my laptop on. I switched everything on. There was a loud bang. The laptop switched itself off. I'm using my daughter's laptop. But other than that, it's good to see you.
So this is the My Little Pony, My Favorite Pony episode?
Yes.
And that's not a euphemism, just to be clear. I had to point that out based on issue 5.
And it's Kelly Gamont.
Hey, how's it going? Aside from the laptop.
I think we know how it's going. You all right?
Yeah, not bad.
Good.
Not bad at all.
I have powered through an entire bottle of Amstel beer in the last 2 minutes, and I'm on the second one already, just in an effort to keep going.
Well played, sir.
Yes.
Yeah, did the first one go into the laptop?
No, it was a coincidence.
Oh, okay.
Issue 5. When in doubt, issue 5.
You can't blame me for issue 5.
Have done.
I was innocent.
And that is Ed Paul Kirkle. On the same side of the Atlantic as myself. Yes. How are you doing? At work? At home?
I finally got home. It's been one of those long days of work that doesn't seem to end. And then I got home, and I got home to this, which is lovely.
Awesome. It looks very good. It looks sun coming through the window.
Yeah, I was trying to get the bookcases in the back, actually, but I couldn't angle the computer and the microphone at the same time.
Sweet. You look very, very chilled. I'm chilled now with the beer. And Jeff and Kelly look chilled. So this episode, issue 6, by the way, issue 6, in case you're confused, we're going to have a talk about the X-Men. Not something I'm an expert on, but I'm looking forward to finding out why I should be. I've never really picked up on them, never liked or followed it, but apparently... I'm a bit of a bozo for not doing that, so I'm going to be told exactly why in a minute. We're going to do the traditional better than against everybody's better judgment. And we've got a bit of a chat about maybe if we have some room, we'll talk about the depiction of women in comics, which is hopefully highbrow and intellectual and get us some brownie points with the university people, and then some picks. So just to crack on, I've also... are fresh off this podcast from having been to the British Tech Network Bash at the weekend, where we've been doing the live podcasts, and where Will Green ceremoniously unlearned everything that Ewan taught me about presenting a podcast.
Perfect.
And if anybody ever listens to the episode when Ewan puts it up, Ewan had a slight attack of the queasies, couldn't host the Mac podcast, handed the microphone over to Will Green, and 30 seconds later it was a wasteland of devastation and destruction.
I've listened to it, it was good fun, but it was, you could tell that a bash had happened.
We were flagging.
I've seen a photo of you and asleep on a bag.
Yeah, it's bad, isn't it?
You know, had I been able to get out for the bash, after Ewan laid down on the floor with his head on the bag, I would have snuck up behind him when I knew he was asleep, curled up with him so someone took a picture of a spooning and then show it to him later. That would have been...
I think actually the most awesome bit was right at the end when the Gamer Show people had done their quiz, and they packed everything up, and we had a projector which was aimed at the wall of the thing, and then one of the person, some heroic person, opened a satchel and said, "I've bought a Nintendo 64 with me and four joysticks. Shall we?"
Oh, very good.
Oh, yes.
I think Gamer possibly wins the bash.
Yeah.
Amazing.
If they'd have said, "Oh, I've bought an Xbox 360 or a PS3, no win. I've bought an N64, win.
I mean, I hate to say it, if they said a Dreamcast and four controllers, ultra win. N64, not bad. Dreamcast, better.
So, Kelly...
But also four controllers.
Kelly... Are you drinking dark rum straight from the bottle? Because that's really what it looks like from this side of the table.
I'm not. It's my SodaStream bottle, and it's got whatever the SodaStream name of Dr. Pepper is. Huh. Straight out the bottle. That's all.
Sorry to disappoint.
I am disappointed. I thought that was just awesome, watching you sitting there taking slugs right out of a dark
pounding rum.
So what we'll do is we'll move on to the what is rapidly becoming the highlight and the thorn in the side of the show, which is where we pick a favorite artist who happens to be better than a certain unnamed UK artist. Jeff, have you got anyone for us at this particular moment in time?
I do, and my artist this week actually crosses over between the UK and the United States, and it's Nelson Daniel. And Nelson is doing the art in the new Judge Dredd series that's being produced specifically for the United States.
Ooh. Oh, that looks pretty cool, he said on a podcast.
Yeah, where you can see what I'm holding up, but our dear listeners can't.
Yes, so explain what's the groove with the art there.
It has that that classic Marvel look from like the late 80s. It kind of feels like that, but with that more modern feel that you have with a lot of comics today. So it's like this really nice crossover in the art. And I just really like how it looks.
Excellent. Brilliant. Kelly, anyone in particular?
Yes, actually. I'm going to find the browser window where I put that because I want to make sure I get the name correct. And it is Carlos Danda. Danda, I'm not sure. D'ANDA. He's the artist on the new Star Wars title out of Dark Horse. And the writer on the title is Brian Wood, and the cover artist is Alex Ross. The covers are nice, but this is one of those that I end up reading twice because I read it to find out what happens, and then I go back through and read it again, where I mostly look at the pictures and check out the artwork, and then sort of, oh, that's right, this is what they were talking about. And then I go back and look at the detail in the art and all of that, and that to me is the mark of something art wise that has gotten my attention. So every time I read a Star Wars title, I go back and I end up reading it twice, and so Carlos Danda is my pick.
Excellent. Paul.
For this week's Better Than You Know Who.
Gosh, we're so well behaved on this podcast, aren't we?
Better than the artist whose name we dare not speak. We could give him a code name. We could start calling him Voldemort.
Gave Dibbons.
Oh, yes. Gave Dibbons. Yes.
What is it?
Paul, who's better than Gave Dibbons?
Who's better than Dave Gibbons? Well,
No. Gave Dibbons.
Oh, Gave Gibbons. Who's better than Gave Schmibbons? I would say, I hate to say, the other Dave. And for one Dave, there has to be another Dave. The Dave that is always better than Dave Gibbons is this guy. Dave McKean. So I'm holding up to the camera, which is also very good for an audio podcast.
You did him last week.
I'll tell you what.
Apparently he's that good.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to do him every week at this rate.
Every week.
This week was London Film and Comics Festival in London, funnily enough. And they had a very rare appearance by Dave McKean talking about his artwork for a new book with SF Side, who did Varjak Paul with him. And because it is one of his rare appearances, he doesn't come to comics expos that often. I was looking after a bouncy castle full of kids and people and stuff on a community fund day that I promised to help out with. And I was so gutted, because Dave McKean is, there is possibly only one artist that will make me gooey from the head down to the toes, and that's Dave McKean. So anyway, he's got a new book coming out soon, August, with SF Said, who did Varjak Paul. It's called Phoenix, and it looks amazing. And if you go onto YouTube, McKean's done a video of artwork for it as a preview, and it looks absolutely gorgeous.
Excellent. Cool. So we forgive you two picks for the same. Who knows? Maybe you picked him in issue 5. We'll never know.
He's the answer to every question graphic designer. Well, true. Actually, I'll tell you what. If any artist took an Asbo out on me, it would be Dave Gibbons and Dave McKean. But for different reasons.
Fair enough.
I'd stroke Dave McKean's beard, I tell you.
Stalky.
Well, okay, now I've got that image in my head. And Kelly, pass over the dark rum, please.
So my pick,
it's all yours.
As the artist that is better than Dave Gave Dibbons,
yep.
Is
Schmibbons.
Is I like to find a reason for the pick. I like to find something that Gave doesn't do very well that other artists do very well. And as I draw myself,
that must be really hard to do.
one of the things that I find hardest is the idea that of making a line go exactly where you want it to go. The idea that you can draw your hand and the line happens, and it's when it finishes, it's exactly where it should be, and it makes the shape that it should be. And the less lines you can use, the better. And this guy is a guy that I consider to be like the absolute master of the alignment. Maybe he used to be a cartoonist. Maybe not so much anymore because he's more involved with animation. And really, I think to a degree, he's shaped modern cartoon animation. And that is Bruce Timm.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Hands up, who's heard of Bruce Timm? Because he seems to be like the unsung hero of stuff. I mean, I have never, to my knowledge, I've never seen a man that can make one line do as much as Bruce Timm can make one line do. There we go.
And what would be some examples of his work then? What are you?
Well, basically, he's an art director at Warner Brothers Animation now. And he's responsible for
the Batman animated stuff.
Yeah.
I saw him recently. Interesting guy.
Yes, he did he basically created the animated look of Batman, Animated Ventures, Justice League of America, all that new wave of animation. Bruce Timm, his art created that.
He's really cool. That's an excellent pick.
And it's just like when you see him pencil, it's just like the graphite on the paper is alive underneath his pencil.
Actually, I say somebody from last week, issue 005, which we never mention, but issue 5 that we don't talk about, we talked about an artist, which we didn't talk about, which was Darwin Cook.
Mm.
Because we didn't talk about Watchmen and the precursors to Watchmen. But Darwin Cook has a very Bruce Timm-like style. Almost Art Deco, beautiful line. I mean, I'm totally with you on Bruce Timm. He's a fabulous artist.
excellent. It's, I mean, if he's got a weakness, it's the ladies.
That's a common weakness, I will say.
In what way?
To be fair. Well,
just Google Bruce Timm and I think you'll...
They don't look fairly weak to me. They look very stereotypical.
Yes, and we'll have a chat about that later. But I mean, some of the, if you look at his pencil sketches, it's like, if I would, there are at least three major limbs that I would give to have that kind of ability with line. Anyway, there we go. Four more artists that are quite good when measured against other artists. Other artists are available. apparently, in issue 5, there was some discussion about various topics, but one of which we'll pick up on maybe later in the podcast. But what I wanted to have a chat about in this episode is maybe the US version of the chance for Jeff and Kelly to give us an ahead of scenes chat, do to us what Paul and I are going to do to you when we do Judge Dredd. But you could do it to us with... probably the holy grail of comics. I mean, if Watchmen is the grail of graphic novels, then X-Men must be the holy grail of the weekly comic strip. And to be honest, it's something I've never really got, even growing up. Maybe because the artists keep changing, the storyline so complex, it keeps resetting itself. How many X-Men have died and come back to life again? Is it all of them? Or
I think it's
pretty much
all of them.
Yes. So, I mean, basically an over...
Well, except for Wolverine, because he can't die.
Yeah, he
can't
die, but
everyone else...
That's true, he did go to hell, but...
I think so, yeah.
But was he really dead when he was there?
I don't know, he's dead.
He's just, they're hanging out.
So, Jeff, can I leave you to... Or does Kelly want to lead off with the X-Men? Why? Why is the X-Men so good? Why is it the gold standard for US comics?
Sure, I'll
please,
start.
Please, Jeff, by
okay.
all means.
I'll bite.
Okay, so the big thing for me about X-Men is that it is the single most dysfunctional family you will ever encounter. I mean, just you're dealing with people that have alcohol and drug abuse issues, people that are misogynistic, people that have... all different types of civil issues, shall we say, and people that are mentally and emotionally unstable, and you have to, and then you throw all these people together in high stress situations, and what could possibly go wrong? Especially when you have a very domineering leader who can read everyone's mind. What could possibly go wrong? So for me, that's the real big thing about X-Men. They've done a fantastic job over the years of taking these incredibly flawed characters, and they have found ways to weave interesting stories around them. They don't even have to be superheroes. It just so happens that in the X-Men, they are. Well, I get very frustrated with the fact that they periodically just throw everything out and start over. That's probably also a good thing, because they don't get lost or bogged down with a lot of ridiculous backstory that goes back decades and doesn't fit with the age of the characters. So, yeah, I don't like that part, but I also like it at the same time. And I like that there's a lot of diversity, and that they go they'll focus on different characters at different times. So it's not like classic Star Trek, where it's the Kirk, Spock, McCoy show. It's they do focus on different characters throughout time, and they also have made so many of these characters gray instead of black hat or white hat characters, like Logan. The only reason he's a good guy is because he happens to hang out with the X-Men. And the only reason Magneto's a bad guy, but he isn't always a bad guy, is because he doesn't hang out with the X-Men. So there you go. That's a very encapsulated version of why I really like the X-Men.
Yeah. Kelly, anything to add?
I think for me, part of what does that is what Jeff was saying, in that it's I know they're mutants, but primarily it's a human story. And so it's a lot about the relationships and people's reactions to other people's decisions for good or ill and that sort of thing, which is the part that makes things resonate no matter what medium you're talking about or what storyline you're talking about. A couple of the other things I enjoy are that the comic, like the film, is set in, it's a world that is taken seriously. And I know this happens more often in comics than it does in films, but it's one of the things that I was really glad to see carry over from the films, or from the comic into the movie, is that the world was taken seriously. Like, this is a real place. Maybe you aren't there right now, but this is totally an actual place. And so for me, that's a thing that I really like about it. And also the humanness of it, I think, with which is a lot of the stuff that Jeff said, it's not necessarily black and white. Logan's not necessarily a good guy. He just hangs out with them right now. And I liked that it is not Trekley, where, you know, somebody who's been in the background for the last year's worth of issues is now suddenly the focus of the story. And I like that they have the option of rotating through, and that also they do, for the most part, they've done a really good job of balance, where just because somebody is not the main character right now doesn't mean nothing is happening with them. It's not like they lock them up in a closet in the X-Men mansion and they just sit there and absolutely nothing changes or evolves about that person while it's not their story. And they don't do that. Like, other stuff happens to other people, and sometimes it's in the comic and sometimes it's not, and it doesn't matter. For me, those are the things that I liked about it, because it's a little less, I know they wear blue and yellow spandex, but it's a little less cartoony, honestly, than what some of the other titles are that I enjoy. And I enjoy them, but I enjoy them for different reasons than I like reading X-Men, than I've ever enjoyed reading X-Men. I started reading X-Men a long time ago. Again, my brother did that. You should read this because it's good. I think it's one that you will like. And he was totally right. I do not like the reboots. All that stuff that you've been invested in for the last 10 years, we're just going to chuck it and start over again. It's nice to have that sort of plot device, but at the same time, I feel like if they just keep doing it, it's going to get really tired in a hurry because of how they handle it. Come on, give me some history. It doesn't have to be 100 years, but you know, 10, maybe 15, that'd be good. So that, I would say Jeff pretty much nailed it as far as the appeal of X-Men. And if you talk to other people who enjoy X-Men and really get them to stop and think about it, I think that they will probably say something similar. It's not quite as clear-cut good guy, bad guy. It's a lot of relationship, and it's not so Magneto has a particular power, or that Professor X can read everybody's minds. It's more about, knowing that, and, you know, how do you work around it, and you know, how does that change the relationships that other people have? So,
have they ever made an X-Men Babies comic? I know that eventually, if you do enough iterations of a comic, you always get around to, like, babies. I figured they must have done an X-Men Babies at some point.
There is... There is a I don't know if it's still being done, but there's something very much like that, and it's done for kids, and it's the X-Men characters. They're like babies. They're little kids, and it's just a very lighthearted, which I know totally contradicts what X-Men is, but it's a very lighthearted take on the characters. So yes, there is an X-Men Babies. All right, so another thing that I really like about X-Men, going back to the whole dysfunctional thing and about it being all about relationships, when Marvel started the Fantastic Four, they had these four characters. They were a family, and they were very dysfunctional.
Yeah,
and the only reason they ended up in go ahead.
That used to really wind me up about the Fantastic Four, that they were bickering, and I was like, guys, you know. I've only read 10 episodes, and in those 10 episodes, you personally, the four of you together, have saved the planet 10 times. So, honestly, stop it.
Mm.
Yes.
Oh, you're such an ingrate, Andy.
You know, they're a dysfunctional family, and they weren't even going to wear comic no, not comics. They weren't going to wear costumes until they're upset. Marvel's, no, you have to put them in a superhero costume. But when the X-Men came along, they took the whole idea of this is about the people, this is about how they interact with each other. Oh, by the way, they happen to have these special powers and they have to go fight bad guys. And the X-Men took that to a level they couldn't do with Fantastic Four, because they could bring in more people, more characters with more issues. And I mean personal issues, not magazine issues. And really, it's stories that are about the people, and they just happen to wear silly yellow and blue spandex.
Is it a US thing, Paul? I mean, you've said earlier that you are actually quite an X-Men fan, despite it all. And does it translate into the UK?
It does and it doesn't. I do find it very US-centric. And don't mind that. And actually, it shouldn't be, because the thing that I like the most about the X-Men is the fact that it was a very international team of mutants and players within the stories. And I love that. I love the fact that Kurt Wagner was German and Piotr was Russian and whoever. But the thing that I don't like about it is it doesn't quite go as far towards what Jeff is saying as I want it to do. So I thoroughly agree with Jeff, and I'm totally there. I agree it's a family, and it's they always call it the most dysfunctional families, and I like that. But it's a family of comic book characters who I don't believe, and I want to believe them a bit more than I do. So, for example, Nightcrawler, I love. He's one of my favourite characters before they turned him into Dark Nightcrawler, which I didn't like. I mm-hmm. cannot stand, for the sake of just anything, Emma Frost, who just irritates the living what's-its out of me. I like the idea of the X-Men more than I like the X-Men.
Mm. And the sort of, for me, as a the most, I mean, you cannot imagine anyone more of a casual dipper in and dipping out of the X-Men than me. And it's this idea that things have moved on, maybe stops me from joining in, and the constant sort of parallel universes and the I'm sure he died 5 years ago and what the hell's he doing here, and Jean Grey, didn't she do, and was she not, and that for me is a big barrier to entry. The only bit that I really like or that I find intriguing is the whole Professor X Magneto sort of duopoly, and the idea that, you know, a lot of the things a lot of the ideas and a lot of the things that Professor X is putting forward, if he wasn't one of the X-Men, if he wasn't in the X-Men's team, he'd be the bad guy. And the same with Magneto. If he wasn't the bad guy, he'd be the good guy. And, you know, this kind of like ebb and flow between the two of them, that one minute one of them's a bad guy, and, you know, that kind of that blurring of the lines is, for me, the only interesting thing about the X-Men.
I like. Sorry, Jeff, you come.
Okay. Yeah, and the thing about Magneto, even though he's the bad guy, and he's wreaking all kinds of havoc, he sees what he's doing as noble, and he doesn't see himself as the bad guy. He's doing what he thinks is right. He's just pretty hardcore about the way he goes about it, because his thing is protect mutants, because mutants are the future. This is our next step in our evolution, and it's,
I mean,
this isn't about good guys and bad guys.
I mean, as a villain, if you compare Magneto to, for example, Doctor Doom from the Doctor, is he Professor Doom or Doctor Doom from the
Doctor Doom?
Doctor Doom.
Doctor
I mean,
Doom.
It's like I always find with Doctor Doom, it's like, and any supervillain per se, Doctor Octopus maybe a little bit from Spider-Man, it's like, it sounds like lovey, but it's like, where's your motivation? Where are you coming from? Why is Doctor Doom such an arse about everything all the time? And I don't ever have a problem with Magneto's motivation, ever. I mean, that is nailed down, absolutely. I mean, sometimes you sympathise more than other times you sympathise, but, you know why he's doing it. And with Professor X, you know why he's doing what he's doing. You know why the X-Men exists. You know why the X-Men exist. And that kind of, that's a, X-Men perhaps has a really, really strong core of belief and motivation to the characters that that most other strips don't have.
You see, I quite like Dr. Tim. I think I can see his motivation and I like it. Because, you know, the whole that variable, I'm going to turn this into the next power state. I can kind of see it's almost got that, you know, silly 80s comedy type thing vibe to it. Dr. Doom I've got no issues with. Magneto I've got no issues with. More or less, I think the whole, he's done all that he's done in the past, but now he's the good guy. I find it very unrealistic towards the fact that the character motivations. The one that I can never get is Professor X. So they try and keep giving a... he's interesting to an extent, and then he's uninteresting. So, for example, he's... They try and give him a little bit of grey area, and then that doesn't work. He's still, like, non-interesting Professor X. So they try and give him a real bad vibe. And one of the jumping-off points... I've read X-Men for much of my comic life, and I like X-Men a lot. Normally I followed it for the artists. But there was one particular moment with Professor X that I thought, I am off for the moment, where he got a sentient robot that crash-landed on the planet, and he knew it was sentient, but he also knew it would work really well as Danger Room, so he turned it into the Danger Room. And I could see why they did Danger Room a reason to exist and a purpose beyond what it was. But it turned Professor X into more of a bad guy, not than Magneto, but equal in many ways. Basically, he took an alien child and turned it into a slave. And you think, no, that's not something that a good guy does in desperation. That's pretty bad. And I don't find the motivations of the characters. I find they switch so north to south so quickly that I don't... I mean, actually, it's what... I can't remember, sorry, Kelly or Jeff, said about history. There, or actually, sorry, it was you, Andy, wasn't it? There's no history. Within 6 months, somebody will go from being the guy who killed half of humanity to being the guy that's petting a puppy. And Logan says, well, actually, you had a bit of a bad day. I can kind of see where you were coming from.
All those people who needed them.
Yeah.
So, is it, I mean, obviously X-Men, the history of X-Men is long, 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 long. When are we going to go for start? Is it 60s, 1960s? Did it start?
It's not as old as Fantastic Four, but it's back there. So, yeah, I believe 60s.
Yeah. I mean, was it always that way in the 60s? I mean, was it as multi-layered or was it sort of crash, bang, thump? I seem to remember a lot of rays shooting out of eyeballs and sort of 30,000 people fighting in a room together and stuff like that going on, and not so much of the grey area and things. Is there a golden age of X-Men, Jeff?
I think a lot of the stuff from the 80s for the X-Men, even though the art didn't always appeal to me, I think that's when they were really experimenting and pushing the envelope with making the characters gray instead of black or white. I think there was a lot of that early on back in the 60s because Stan Lee loved the idea of flawed characters. And that's why he made characters that fought with each other and were alcoholics and were kids that didn't have the life experience to handle the powers that they had, as opposed to DC, which created gods. And so, yeah, so there was conflict between the characters back in the 60s, but it didn't have the edge that it had later on. But I think if you're reading it back then, you wouldn't have realized, because at the time, that was really edgy, and that was really pushing the envelope to have these very flawed characters. So it was there, it's just more so now.
Kelly, I know your face has disappeared from my screen, but I'm assuming you're still there.
I'm still there.
Still there. Is it the 80s for you?
I am, really. it is, and specifically not just the 80s, but the Dark Phoenix stuff. There's a storyline called the Dark Phoenix Saga, I believe. That's a big one. And all of the stuff that happened in the 80s when they sort of took that turn and started to sort of muddy the black and white was Chris Claremont. He was the guy responsible for that. And I'm glad of him because it means that he did a lot, and he worked on the title for a long time, and he was very familiar with the characters. And so a lot of, you know, the care and the love sort of comes through in that. And that's the sort of thing that makes it easier to forgive. We've talked about this, I think, here before. The care and the love is something that makes it so that you can sort of forgive some of the more ridiculous shots of beams out of eyeballs or stupid things that Wolverine says or whatever. Like, you can forgive some of that because you know about the love and the care and attention that goes into that. And that's what I would say. In the 90s, I want to say it was like 90 or 91, maybe Jeff can back me up on this. X-Men was a huge title for Marvel in the 80s. Like, huge, huge, huge. And in 90 or 91, they started... There was some stuff with, like, one of our other show favorites, Rob Liefeld. And him and Chris Claremont were at loggerheads, and then Claremont left. Something happened, and Claremont bailed, and he started doing his own X-Men title, and there ended up being 3 or 4 or 9... different X-Men titles.
Well, 86.
It could have been 203. I don't remember. But it was, that's basically the line where I ended up having to give up on it, was because I just couldn't read as many comics as they were giving me at a time. I literally didn't have the time. I was in college and it sucked.
Yep. I was in the same boat. That was just, it was too much. And the storylines didn't match up. And so it was really difficult to follow. It was way too many titles. And that was back when I think we were seeing a lot of the frantic collapse in the comic book industry, where the senior editors were doing everything they could to monetize, and they were really exploiting the characters, and it was just... It was kind of a dark time for comics, and since X-Men was popular, the answer was make more X-Men titles. Huh. And you had these teams that were working completely independently of each other, and it was just a mess.
But actually, I'll tell you what. Sorry, Andy. All I was going to say was when I talk to guys who used to read comics in the 80s who stopped in the 90s, most of us can point to Rob Liefeld and Jim Lee and Todd McFarlane as being the things that stopped us.
Todd McFarlane, yeah. Really?
Oh, yeah, honestly, it just got the whole Spawn thing, where he's got a cloak that's about 72 metres of fabric curled around a church spire. I mean, oh, for crying out loud, have we not seen that a million times? But, I mean, Todd McFarlane... I dislike least out of that, the troop of guys, and to an extent, Will Pulcinio and whatever. But 1991, I'm just looking up the history of X-Men on Wikipedia at the moment. 91, when we had the Jim Lee variant covers and the brand new X-Men comic, and that to me was like this whole multiple interlocking covers of X-Men Volume 2 type thing. That to me was when it just died, and you had this horrible inked in muscles on people and the girls with ridiculous breasts type thing, and the whole Jim Lee-ization of
I thought
it was just me.
No, I think, are you there? Who's still around? It's the joys of Skype. I think Paul has fallen off the planet. Is that a mad 5 minutes for Skype?
I think he's off entirely.
Yeah.
Oh, there we go.
Well, crazy technology.
Honestly, it's almost like the internet is 1996 again. I mean, I'd stop me if you can't hear me. Well, I'm recording, so it's going to get recorded anyway. For me, one of the things that always used to put me off the X-Men. I never felt that they got the best art. I think, you know, Superman always got the artists, Batman got the artists, but I felt that despite the Premier League of the comic, the X-Men never got the artists that it deserved.
That's probably fair.
Yeah, I'll go with you on that, sure.
Why not? Nobody's listening anymore. It's all gone to pot.
Yeah. No, it's true. You know, and when you look at a lot of what was being done art-wise back in the 70s, really into the 80s and early 90s, you saw a lot of, I hate to call it sweatshop art, but really that's what a lot of it was like. It was, here's an issue, it needs to happen now, and you throw the story at someone and mm-hmm. they just have to crank out the same art over and over to get these multiple storylines out as quickly as they can.
Yeah.
I mean, does that tie into the thing that obviously the X-Men appear to have been guilty of, which is that, you know, 30 issues a week, different artists, different universes, different stuff going on, and you've just got to grab whatever artist you can find and give them a plot to draw, mm-hmm. get it out the door, because it's your big cash cow.
Yeah.
I think that has a lot to do with it.
Yeah. And the stories suffered. The whole industry suffered for that. And Marvel and DC both played into that in a really big way.
Yeah.
And
Superman and Spider-Man both suffered from the same. Yeah, we have 96 titles. I'll find someone in the hallway who's standing still long enough and get them to illustrate a title.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not that I don't remember some truly shocking Batman art in the 80s. I mean, some of it was just, you know, somebody's. I think the artists were handing stuff over to their mothers to draw for them because they were so busy. But
well, I'm pretty sure for some issues, they were just walking out of the hall and they were saying, "You pushing the mop, put that down and grab a pencil."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think part of it is the fracture of the titles. You know, we make a lot of money on X-Men. If we had three X-Men titles, we'd make three times the money, was sort of, I think, what they were going for. And so the ones that stand out in my mind as being five or six titles at a time were X-Men and Spider-Man and Superman. They both had a couple of stretches of time where there were a lot of Spider-Man titles and a lot of Superman titles.
Well, then you also had the thing where they were looking at which character is popular right now, put them in every comic. And so mm-hmm. then you start having X-Men, popular X-Men characters just being scattered out across all of these other comics.
Mm. Yeah.
And in many cases, it felt like the character was there, not because it was integral to the story, but because someone said jam the character in. And I think
someone
that
else
really
will buy that comic with Wolverine in it.
Hmm. Yes. And so I think that really hurt the X-Men franchise.
I mean, it's very much, it's a franchise where everyone has their own favorite character. I mean, there are people that are Wolverine fans. There are people that are Gambit fans. There are people that are, you know, whatever.
Certainly.
Fans. And yeah, the idea is, geez, let's do a strip. Let's do this. People seem to like that. Let's do a strip on this. And you know, and there's so many characters in the franchise that you can just keep iterating that on and on and on until it just becomes a big spaghetti mess.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean,
yeah, and that's exactly right. A big spaghetti mess.
Do you think that the film cut through that in some way? I mean, by concentrating on a core bunch of characters in the way it did.
I think that was really smart for the movie because you have so many characters and the storylines do get to be so complex that being able to trim that down and mm-hmm. give viewers a more manageable set of characters, I think was really smart.
Yeah, I think the first two films did a really good job of that. And I think X-Men First Class also did a good job of that.
Are you saying X-3?
I really did enjoy it.
X-3, not so much?
We don't talk about X-3.
We did talk about X-3. I think we talked about it in issue 5, didn't
yeah,
we?
Yeah, probably. It feels double-spaced to me as a film.
Sorry, Paul?
It's got fan favourite actor Vinnie Jones in a sequential role. You can't argue with X-Men 3.
You know, The minute I saw
you. You know, you can't fight with logic like that.
No.
No. Actually, I'll tell you what, they killed the Juggernaut. I love Juggernaut as a character. He's one of my favorite X-Men bad guys. And Vinnie Jones was not the Juggernaut.
Vinnie Jones isn't any. He's barely Vinnie Jones.
Oh, no, he's very wow. Vinnie Jones, but he ain't much of a Juggernaut.
He's not anything else, is he? He really isn't.
But I'll tell you what, I don't want to add to our cast of bad guys, but Shmave Schmibbins is one thing. Vinnie Jones, I wouldn't want upset, so he was fine. He was all right.
Well, there you go.
He's bigger than me.
Yes. All right.
So, I mean, to sort of seek into just a brief discussion that we could, and we might expand it next week, see how we go. I mean, obviously, the X-Men, one of the things the X-Men has is, like, major cast, lots of male characters, lots of female characters, lots of spandex flying around. And one of the things I'm quite interested in, and I've been looking at in the last couple of weeks, is you know, drawing women cartoon characters. And we, you know, my pick of the week, better than Shmave Schmibbins, Bruce Timm. He's the, you know, in a lot of ways, he's the epitome of, like, the girly comic strip artist. And the X-Men did a lot of that. I mean, all of the female characters, you know, 15-inch waist, massive boobies, spandex and things. Is that a thing in comics? I mean, why is that a thing? Is it because it's a thing because boys buy comics, is it not?
Because
it's the audience, yeah.
Yeah. You're giving, oh God, I'm totally going to get hate mail for this. You're giving guys and boys that can't get dates the sexual excitement that they're looking for.
You're giving them dates.
Are we there with this? Gosh, this audio, this poor old Skype. It seems to, at a certain point every episode, it seems to think you've had enough. But I mean, and in some ways, there's, I mean, even like the great artists that I think are absolutely brilliant. I mean, Brian Bolland, he's reasonably asexual artist in a lot of ways. Dave Gibbons, Ian Gibson, Halo Jones, which is a strip designed for women. The depiction of the women in Halo Jones is still fairly standard bimbo. They're still wearing spandex. They're still, you know, stripped to the midriff, etc., etc. You know, Brian Bolland, his line work is super clean. It's super things. And then suddenly, pow, you've got Judge Anderson popping out of the woodwork. Paul, I mean, anything you...
Yeah, but Anderson wasn't a bad female character. I mean, she was... It's all gone quiet again.
Uh-oh.
Sorry, can you hear me?
No, yeah, I can. It just went silent and I get paranoid now. Anderson wasn't bad. I mean, she was ridiculously shapely, but she wasn't... I mean, it wasn't that she had her top unzipped all the time and showing flesh all over the place. On Anderson, I didn't hate, if that makes sense. And there are some characters I absolutely hate. Like Emma Frost, I just hate. And I loved Grant Morrison's run on the X-Men, for example. Mm. And E is for Extinction is one of the high points of modern X-Men to me. But I still look at the covers that Frank Quitely did, who's a hell of an artist, of Emma Frost. I just think, no, this is just silly now. And it's gone beyond silly. And I just thought it was stupid. And Bolland has had his moments with Cheesecake like you wouldn't believe, where you just think, ah, no, Bolland, you've got the old Frank Frazetta, Boris Vallejo book out there and you're not tracing it because you wouldn't... Bolland's a hell of an artist. He wouldn't need to do that. It's just the audience. And I remember very well. I took some... Because I'm a teacher. I take students to things that are relevant to the course, which is graphic design. And we do a lot of illustrated narrative, so comics come into it very well. Not just because I like it. So we took them to the MCM Comic-Con, Comics Expo, which I loved. And we took them to the London International Technology Show. And there were a lot of cosplayers there. And there were a lot of cosplaying girls who were dressed in ways that if they had walked down the street not at a comic convention, they would be arrested for public indecency. But because it was a convention, it was fine. And I was not uncomfortable with it, but I just thought, if I had my daughter here with me, I think I would have been a little uncomfortable about it. But we were going through London Technology Show, and these two ridiculous booth babes came out of a stand, walked right in front of me with a bunch of students, walked away from us with bits jiggling all over the place, not particularly well covered. And one of the students just looked at them, looked back at me and said, well, you got to say they do know their audience. And that's what it comes down to.
Mm. Yep. Yeah.
Kelly, I mean, as a, obviously you've introduced us, you've introduced us, you know, as the podcaster and me and everyone and people that I talked to at the Bash, you've introduced us to Stumptown, which is the patron saint of things. And one of the things that I immediately loved about the comic, and for me, it's the single best thing about the whole comic, is the strong female lead who is drawn as an absolutely realistic human female with no, mm-hmm. you know, and as a girl reading comics, do you find with X-Men, with Supergirl, with Marvel Girl, with Wonder Woman, is it a barrier to entry for women that this is ridiculous depiction going on all the time?
Yes, and I would say for a girl reading comics, when I started reading comics, which was sort of, like I said, because my brother used to, and I just am I'm a big reader. I read everything. When I was a kid, I had read everything I could reach, and so I pulled down the phone book and read, like, all that stuff at the beginning of the phone book because I hadn't read it yet.
Oh, God, hang on. Can I stop you for a minute?
Yes.
You mean someone else in the world did that?
Yes, I totally did.
Holy Jesus, I've never met anyone else that did that.
I absolutely did, guys. I hadn't read it yet, and it was a really big book.
No,
I was like four.
It's got all this stuff at the front about dialing tones and things and what it means. And
it's actually kind of interesting, well, to people like us.
Holy crap. Anyway, carry on. Sorry.
Like, I read everything. So I'd read, you know, I didn't have a new book, and my brother goes, here, have a comic. And then I was like, okay, how does this turn out? And so that was, you know, how I ended up in comic books. But I'm sort of a special breed, I guess. And I'm going to go with Gold Star Special in that respect. I'm used to being the only girl. I was the only girl that read comic books. I was the only girl that liked Star Wars. I was the only girl that played baseball. I was the only girl a lot. The only girl in computer class. The only girl, whatever. Go ahead and pick. I grew up in a really small town. I was the only one. And I was a girl besides. So I was the only girl a lot. So for a lot of stuff, it didn't bother me. Although as time has gone on, those depictions have gotten more and more unrealistic. And if you look at the way women are posed in comics, like just when they're standing around or whatever, you will see a dramatic difference between a panel with some women in it and a panel without women in it, as far as how people stand around, how people just sort of are when they're in between things. Like, I'm standing here having a conversation with you, and then I'm off to save the world. Like, they are very different poses. That's fine. There's actually a really interesting phenomenon about this that somebody took that is called the Hawkeye Initiative. And what they've done is taken Hawkeye and drawn him this same way that a woman is drawn on the on the cover of a comic or in a particular panel of a comic.
That is so
It makes me really happy that this exists. Yeah. It's hilarious. If you get a chance, go look up the Hawkeye Initiative. Anybody that's listening. It's
okay, so now the unrealistic depiction of women in comics, it applies to men also. However, it's much more noticeable in women because you end up with the giant boobs and the unrealistic waistlines and hips and you know, that
and
kind
no
of stuff.
Waist.
And no waist. But if you look at male characters, Superman in many cases, Captain America in a lot of the comics that he's drawn in, if that was a real life person, their chest and shoulders would be almost 3 feet across. Excuse me. And the only thing really that I think is missing from that part of it, which is what really sets the unrealistic drawings of women apart, is that they're not doing like a giant moose knuckle on the guys. And but you still have the giant boobs and the big ass and all that on the women.
I've not heard it called that before.
Well, I think also, though, there's been, over time, there has also gotten to be more of a culture of permissiveness in society. So, you know, something that now is overtly ridiculous and, you know, she's basically not wearing anything
you know, that would never have flown like 20 years ago or 30 years ago. That's just not something you would have seen. They would have actually been wearing, you know, a minimum of clothing. And now, realistic either.
Oh, my word, Skype, another mad moment from Skype. Hey, Jeff, are you still there?
Yeah.
And pause.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, there's Wonder Woman, there's Batgirl, Supergirl, and things like that. But I think the epitome of the whole thing for me is Power Girl, and I just, like, can't even cope with it.
Power
are we back?
Girl. Maybe.
Kels?
Are we back?
To the what?
I don't know. Am I here?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Can hear you.
Muted.
Yes, I can hear you.
Unpause.
Yeah,
right.
Pause.
Right. Okay, we're back on. So, yes, as we said,
right.
Basically, Jeff, Power Girl. What the hell? I mean, is somebody taking the mickey?
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
I mean, okay, so the whole thing with Power Girl, when she was just Supergirl, and it was fine. And I really think that they just wanted to make a more sexually provocative costume and make the character more sexually provocative as well. So she becomes Power Girl. And they do the giant cleavage cutout and the super high cut hips and I mean that character. I couldn't even tell you anything about any Power Girl stories. All I know is that every time I've read an issue, all that I walk away with at the end is, it's a good thing. With as little as she's wearing and with as sheer and as white as that costume is, they never have her fall in water.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly, is Power Girl one step too far for you?
I just never could get into the story was really all it was. And honestly, when it comes to comics, sometimes I do judge a book by its cover. And I took one look at that outfit and just went, no, just no.
No,
there was, you know, like, I don't have a better like reaction than that. That's exactly what it was. I just, with the cutout and everything, I never understood how we got from Supergirl to Power Girl. That was really my concern. And it wasn't the new outfit and it wasn't any of that. It was just, how did we get from there to here? And I can't figure it out. And it wasn't worth my time to try.
Yeah, well, see, and the stories from the handful of issues that I looked at, there weren't compelling stories. So all you really had were the drawings. And there was one key aspect of the drawings, and that was to have the provocative costume and to put her in positions that you're assuming they just forgot to draw the guy for the porno.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, for me, that was the thing that was sort of frustrating about it. And so I never really got into it for that reason. It wasn't any fun to read. And I always want something that's fun to read.
I mean, I think in some ways, it historically looking back, Wonder Woman, who was also famously, you know, fairly bad, but some of her, you know, the writing in Wonder Woman has perhaps been a little more sympathetic to the female character, has perhaps been more developmental. Yeah, has been more interesting, flat out interesting, which has allowed Wonder Woman to survive for as long as she has. But you're thinking there's a little sort of, maybe only a tiny bit more interesting. You're not a Wonder Woman fan, Kelly?
No, I do like Wonder Woman. And I like, the bummer is that it doesn't take much to be way more sympathetic and way more pro-lady than any comic out there today. Like, you don't have to try that hard. And then, you know, to find out that, like, the big, you know, they were going to do another, they were considering, I don't remember if it was a series or a movie for Wonder Woman, with all
it,
of
it was
the
series.
It was the series. And
the pilot was kind of painful. I managed to get to see it and, wink, wink. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
I'm glad it wasn't picked up.
They didn't, like, the biggest conversation at DC was not, which way do we go with her origin story? It was not how much do we throw back to the original.
Okay, bye.
Does she wear pants?
Mm.
This was the conversation that DC was having over and over and over. And for me, that's really frustrating because that should be the least, the like really low down the list.
Yeah.
There should be a lot of other things that come into consideration before that. And I found that really frustrating. And it's part of what I think for me, it's just sort of giving Stumptown bonus points because Stumptown is well-written. Stumptown is well-drawn. And as an added bonus, it happens for me. As an added bonus, it happens to feature a woman as the main character. It happens to be set in Portland, in actual places I've actually been to. It has all these bits and pieces additionally. But the thing that I think is the best about Stumptown is that it could have been a guy in the lead role, and it would have been a good story. And I think there's a certain amount of that you have to have. You can't just make the whole thing about being a woman. And it can't all be about, gosh, I'm just a girl. What am I going to do as a, you know, no, you're a superhero. If you're a badass, you're a badass. It doesn't matter if your plumbing is indoor or outdoor. Done. Just like, it doesn't, there doesn't have to be a hang up like, oh gosh, what am I going to wear to kick this guy's butt? No, no, that's not how it works. And that's one of the things I think that works about X-Men is that with X-Men, to bring it back full circle, they happen to be superheroes, but they're all having, they all have this family dynamic. They all have these relationships. They have all this other stuff that's going on and they're superheroes. And that being incidental to the story is what makes it a good story. And I want there to be more of that in comics where it's about a woman, but it's not about her being a woman. And I know the difference is very small semantically, but like as a concept, it's very, very different. And it shouldn't be about being a girl. It should be about, like, you know, if it's a comic, let's be honest, if it's a comic, it's probably about a bad guy who needs his ass kicked. And if it happens to be a girl who does the ass kicking, awesome. It shouldn't be about what shoes she's wearing. It shouldn't be about the fact that no back in the history of spines has ever bent that way ever. Like, it doesn't need to be those things. And the good thing is that, like every other avenue for publishing, there's a lot of other people out there who are doing good work, who happen to be female, who are drawing actual ladies, who are drawing interesting stories, who are doing more than what Marvel and DC, basically, because they're the big two, Marvel and DC have sort of trained people into thinking as far as girls. So I'm really glad to see that that sort of democratizing is happening in comics, just like it's happened in books, just like it's happened in nonfiction, in short form writing, in long form writing, in journalism. This is another printed medium that I'm really excited to see the balance shift a little bit. Like, Image kicked that off in the 90s, but it wasn't about ladies. It was about Rob Liefeld wanted his way. But they did step outside the system and creators' rights and gave owners a stake in things. And that's a good thing, too. That was like the first piece of making all this other stuff happen. So it's now possible for comic book ladies to be less ridiculous. And that makes me really happy. I've done a lot of overlooking and I've done a lot of eye rolling. And I really am glad that now there is someone, and I know how dumb this sounds coming from me, but there's someone in a comic who looks like me, and that, like, in Stumptown, like, she's just a girl, and she's not super tall, and she's not super skinny, and she's not super endowed, and all of those things make her more relatable. And so to me, that's another piece of the hand flapping and the joy and me clutching Stumptown and taking it with me everywhere I go because I have a hardcover, and going and hitting people with it and going, read this, read this, read this, read this, because it's a really awesome story that happens to be a comic that happens to star a woman. And those are the things to me that more of that, as more of that happens, and like as I tell you guys, oh my god, go read Stumptown, and then you did, and then you liked it, and now you guys are going and telling people, oh my god, go read Stumptown. Those are the pieces that are going to make this change. And I really don't want it to be the kind of thing where like I feel obligated to buy a comic because a woman created it or because it has a female character. I want it to be something that's really great on its own. And we're getting to that point now, and that makes me really happy.
You know, I have to jump back to the Wonder Woman thing for just a minute. As you've been talking, like, it's been it kind of jailed in my head. Why Wonder Woman frustrates me so much. I find Wonder Woman to be a very compelling character, and there's so much that can be done with her. Wonder Woman can be a voice of social commentary through comic books, because she is apart from men and women, because she's an Amazon warrior, and she is in essence an alien to our culture. And so she comes in and she gets to see the way women are treated and the way people interact with each other. And she can comment on these things because they are very foreign to her. And Wonder Woman can be used as a character to point out a lot of these weird social things that go on. Mm-hmm. And DC does a little bit of that with Wonder Woman in the comic books, but they don't take it as far as they can. They did do a animated Wonder Woman movie that I got a chance to see recently, where I forgot the woman that voices Wonder Woman, but Steve is voiced by Nathan Fillion, which is actually irrelevant to this part of the story, unless someone is going out to try and find it, because I can't remember the name of it. Yeah, but it was really cool. And they actually looked at a lot of the social and personal interactions between men and women through Diana's eyes. And she was portrayed as very strong and very self-confident, and it was done really well. But they could have taken it even farther had they wanted to, and so I find that to be very frustrating, because here's this character that you could do so much with to talk about social issues and interaction between people, and they're just not doing it.
Maybe you know, if it's moved from if what Kelly's been describing in Stumptown moves from the independent comics, from the small comics, it will. You know, if the independent comics gain traction, if the sales go up, if the big, I mean, the major comics guys are always looking downstream at what's happening in terms of, you know, themes and interests and things, and they'll, you know, these things get picked up on and they get moved into the mainstream. It's just a matter of I think it's just a matter of time in a lot of ways.
I hope so, and I'm hoping that the animated Wonder Woman movie is an indication of where DC is going with the character, because Diana should be a voice, and she should be a strong character, and she should be strong because of who she is, and not because she's a woman. Or the gender part shouldn't have to matter. It's just very frustrating.
Anyway, I'm just looking at the time. We're on Skype and thinking, good grief. I want to do some pick. Paul, are you back with us?
I'm back with you, yep.
Brilliant. In case anything happens, we're going to do the picks now for everyone. And we're going to cut to Paul, who's had horrendous Skype issues, which is why you've probably not been interjecting as much as you probably would have liked to in that discussion. Oh.
Blimey, I don't even know what's going on Skype tonight, but I've crashed out 3 times tonight, and it's just me. Right, keeping along with the strong, for the right reasons, female side of things, there is a comic book writer called Sam Keefe, and most people would know him, if they knew him for anything, for the artwork in Wolverine and Ghost Rider. And Marvel did an anthology comic called Marvel Presents for a long time. Was it Marvel Presents? something along those lines, Marvel Heroes or whatever, which was a weekly comic, and he did some really glorious Wolverine stuff in there. And he's an artist with a very, very specific vision and way of drawing things. And I've always been very fond of Sam Keefe as an artist. And then he jumped over to the Image ship. And again, with Kelly, I'm well into Image as an idea of giving creators their own voice and paying for that. And Image at the moment are the most wonderful thing. If of all of the comic companies at the moment, Image to me are the most interesting by far, and they're always coming out with the most interesting stuff. And Saga and Invincible and Walking Dead, and so much stuff is coming out of Image as a comic company. But their greatest hour to me was giving Sam Keefe a writer's gig with the Max. And the Max was this absolutely fabulously bonkers piece of comic fiction which had serial killers and weird sexual relationship therapists and a bunny rabbit that was a spirit guide and teenage angst at school coming out in the most horrible and painful ways. And it was fabulous. And it ran for, I think, about 100 issues. And each issue was the most beautifully written, carefully thought out. And Sam Keefe wrote it. I seem to remember James DeMatteis, I think it was, who wrote the dialogue or tidied that up. And it was gorgeous. And it was so well done. But the thing that Sam Keefe did the best was he wrote female characters brilliantly, I think. I mean, I can't tell because I'm not reading it from that side of the fence. But I looked at the way he wrote a girl and thought, that is like a lot of girls I know. And it wasn't, they acted foolishly and they acted brilliantly and they were childish and they were adult and they were brilliant. And they were characters that I could instantly relate to. And the guy characters in the Max were possibly as well drawn, but the girl characters were the stars of the show. And if you want a comic book which is based around female heroes that are not necessarily role models, because they were awful at times, but if you want a comic book and that had fit. Now, I know Andy's going to say, well, hang on a sec, this is Halo Jones, which is entirely fine, because Halo Jones is the UK female-led comic book brilliance. The epitome of fabulous female comic book heroes is Halo Jones. But to me, the epitome of US comic book brilliance, female-led, fabulous storytelling is Sam Keefe's The Max. And his artwork is brilliant, but it turned out that he was one of the best comic book writers that I could point to.
Excellent. That sounds
awesome.
Yeah, definitely. I'm overused words, but absolutely. Kelly, have you got anything for us?
I do, but I'm trying to track it down. So talk to Jeff first.
Jeff, talk to Jeff, quick.
Cut to Jeff. So sticking with the idea of strong female characters, I found a new series from Image called Lazarus, and the premise of the story is it's a little ways in the future. Traditional political government around the world has fallen, and the planet is now run by essentially family corporations. And so with medical technology where it is, each family can invest a lot of technology into medical technology into one person, and that person is their Lazarus, which is a human that's been genetically modified so that basically they can't die. And the Lazarus for this one family is this female character. And she will go out and be the hitman and the enforcer and to deal with whatever really nasty, dirty problems need to be dealt with, which can be people trying to infiltrate the family businesses and cause trouble there, or it can be pretty much anything. So you have this female character that can't die, but she can certainly certainly feel pain. And there starts her getting shot several times, falling to the floor dead, and then coming back to life a couple minutes later, and then having to get up while she's bleeding and in pain and go and stop these people that had just shot her up really bad. And she has to keep dealing with her own morals and trying to figure out really what is right and what's wrong, and balancing that with her her orders that she's given and having to go out and kill people. So anyhow, the story is interesting. The artwork, okay, so the story's written by Greg Rucka, and the art is by Michael Lark, colored by Santi Arcus, and so you've got this grown-up art happening like that, and you have these really interesting stories to go along with it. And hold on, for everyone that can actually see what we're looking at, I mean, you get these nice shots of people that are just having to interact with each other in horrible situations, and you can really feel the anguish in their faces. Like at one point, there's one character that realizes if he's going to save his family, he has to lie and say he committed a crime, and he does, and he knows exactly what his punishment will be for doing that, and you can feel the anguish in his face through the drawings. It's done really well. So great artwork, really interesting story. And it's called Lazarus from Image.
Excellent. Did you find it, Kelly?
Yeah, I did. Well, I've got a backup pick. Before we move on, though, I do want to point out that the writer of Lazarus is Greg Rucka.
Sam Stumptown.
Right? Yep. Who also did Stumptown.
Mm-hmm. So, there you go.
Yeah. Kelly likes Stumptown. Don't know if she's noticed. I was going to pick because there was a new... Here's the thing. I can't find it. There was like a new 2000 AD that was released maybe on Comixology or something, and it had a new Dread story in it, and I was trying to track that down because I thought I picked it up, but I can't find it anywhere. So it's actually sadly not my primary pick. My pick is Saga, which I believe the first issue is free on Comixology if you're looking for something digital. And I believe the first issue is free. And it's a really, so far, interesting story. I haven't read it yet, but it's about a couple of people who are from two different planets who are at war. And the reason they're at war, the two planets aren't at war, but the two different races of people are at war because there was a war that was started on Earth. And then on Earth, they decided to outsource the war. And so now Earth is peaceful because they've outsourced all the fighting to basically the rest of the universe. And these two people have fallen in love and had a child, and this is the story of the child. And so she's born kind of near the beginning of the first issue, and she says, this is my story. And so I'm not sure where it's going to go, but I really do want to find out. It looks really interesting. It's a lot of fun, and I can't wait to see where it goes. So my pick this week is Saga.
Yeah, I had a look. Yes, Saga, issue one, indeed, free on Comixology. So
yay!
Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? That's the beauty of Comixology. It's your main line drug into new comics.
I was going to say, that's the bad thing about Comixology as well, is digital crack again.
Yeah.
When it comes to comic books.
Yeah, I'm going to read this now, and then in 10 minutes or half an hour's time, I'm going to be downloading a hell of a lot more of Saga and spending all the spare money I've got on this instead of food.
And in this case, you can blame Kelly.
Yes, I'm
again.
I'm feeling a bit like I should have tried harder at this game of picking a pick. That I mean, I know that we threw the women in comics thing out at the beginning of the thing, and everyone's managed to come through and say, "Oh, I've got this pick, and it's got a strong woman in it." My pick's got no strong women in it. What it has got is spaceships, arsing big guns.
All right, I'm in.
Aliens, spacesuits, and.
Okay.
And Cam Kennedy. What do you think, Paul? Spaceships, big guns, spacesuits, Cam Kennedy. Where am I going?
Jim, the Forever War. No, the name's on the tip of my tongue.
Oh, VC.
VCs, yes.
Yes, absolutely, the VCs. Yes,
republished on Amazon, the VCs, yep. Their first series, You're Hit, You're Dead, the VCs, interstellar war between the geeks. Can you tell what they're standing in for at this point in the story? And the humans. But if you could avoid that, because it's an early 80s one, and I think they probably thought, oh, we'll call them geeks and it'll be clever. It's not clever anymore, but maybe it was slightly intelligent back then. I don't know. But when I read it, for me, the story was interesting. The characters were interesting. But, you know, it was an early example of Cam Kennedy going, this is how you do spaceships and things. This is what you do. And it's just, it completely stands the test of time. I picked the Light and Darkness War back in issue one, which is also a Cam Kennedy penned thing.
Which is the thing that I was thinking of just now.
Yeah. But Cam Kennedy, he's quite unsung, isn't he? In terms of, you know, top line artists, he's not one that pops into your head, but he really is up there. I mean, he's...
Do you know what? Some of my favourite dreads are by Cam Kennedy. And people don't... When people talk about dread artists, they'll talk about Bolland and they'll talk about McMahon, who are both fabulous. But Cam Kennedy, they won't often talk about because he did bring the chin out a bit too far.
Yeah.
But Chopper is one of the best dread stories of all time. And he did a couple others. The Art of Kenny Who was just brilliant.
Yeah.
I am totally into Cam Kennedy. I think he's an absolutely fabulous, fabulous artist. And yeah, hideously underrated.
I think that perhaps his dread is his weakest card, but it's still a strong card. But it's
no, sorry, The Art of Kenny Who is one of the best, full stop.
I suppose that little, I guess it's just popped into my head, that illustration of Kenny Who with his portfolio at Customs in Mega City 1 with the judge leaning over him. Really, yes, really good. Awesome. I don't know why I remember these images, but anyway. So the VCs, You're Hit, You're Dead, just out on in Amazon for. God, it's not. Jesus, it's a little expensive, but there you go.
But not as expensive as Zenith.
No, we'll do Zenith next week because I think Jeff probably needs to go. News from the comics podcast. Probably not next week. Maybe not the week after. We've been hemming and hawing. We're going to do a Judge Dredd special. We're going to get to Judge Dredd. Sorry,
Jeff. Very special.
Sorry, Kelly. You might have to gen up on him. We're going to do Judge Dredd because it's Judge Dredd. When we do Judge Dredd, week after next, whenever it is, we'll be doing Judge Dredd in the presence of Carlos Esquerra, the creator of Judge Dredd's look and feel. And possibly, hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll be doing it in the presence of Pat Mills and John Wagner. So I'm not sure we could get more awesome than that.
Do I need to read in the meantime? This is what I need to know.
All of it.
I'm
next week's about the homework list.
Yes. We'll email you.
Okay.
Jeff and Kelly, we'll email you Judge Dredd homework list. I mean, pretty much up to the Apocalypse War, really, isn't it? After that, Esquerra's gone and Wagner's got no interest.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, Day of Chaos is interesting. I'll give you that.
Yeah. But we'll send you a list, guys. But when and as and when we do the Judge Dredd, I mean, Esquerra, we've had contact with him. He's definitely up for it. And from intimations that the other two, Pat Mills and Wagner, are also up for it. And that will be truly awesome.
Oh, fabulous.
So keep it peeled. We'll let you know when Judge Dredd's coming. Jeff, where can we find you?
Oh, you can find me at macobserver.com. You can find me on Twitter and app.net. I'm Jay Gamut, both places. You can also find me at Apple Context Machine. We have Communicators, The Big Show here, sometimes on the Mac Show. And Google me, people. You can find me almost anywhere.
Yeah. Just put Jeff Gamut into Google. You won't be... Nothing bad will come up.
Probably not.
I'm typing Jeff Gamut NSFW at the moment. I'll see what... Blimey!
Oh, yeah.
Depending on your perspective...
Is that a body double, Jeff?
That's good or bad.
Kelly, where are you?
No, it's all done with lighting.
You can find me on Twitter and app.net as Verso. And you can also find me hosting the unofficial Apple weblog to Totcast.
And you can also find me on The Mac Show right here on this very network.
And Paul?
You can find me on the Minternets, various places. If you type in Kercal, kercal.co.uk, you'll get a little window onto all sorts of things.
Excellent. Yes, our iPad artist supreme, and there's lots of stuff of yours online that people can look at. I've got one thanks to do and one not thanks. We'll do a thank you to, as ever, UK2 bandwidth suppliers. In extremis, I mean, we did the bash. Ewan thanked them. He was pointing out how many years that the network has been, you know, supported by UK2, how many years going forward the services that they provide for the network. I mean, none of the podcasts would happen if UK2 went there. Go to uk2.net, have a look. Domain management, you know, registering websites, website, you know, online live website builders. It's all there, and you know, more importantly, it's the price is right and the service is super reliable, and the customer support, which is the hardest thing to get right, is what they get right. So thank you, UK2. Have some more bandwidth, courtesy of the Comics Podcast. And we are thankful. And we'd like to say thanks to Skype, who have once again held together like baling twine and string were never invented. Well done. Thank you very much, listeners, for the audio. It's dropped in, it's dropped out. We've been here, we've been there. Next week, when I've got my computer back up and running, with the cooperation of the other guys in the podcast, I'm going to ask people to record their own Skype audio at their end. And we'll sync it up and we'll bin it into it. And I'm going to bloody put it together in GarageBand, because that way we'll get some decent audio, because Skype patently has no idea how to maintain a broadband connection. Thank you, Microsoft. You're a wonder. and that's it. Thank you very much for listening. This has been six of the comics podcast from the British Tech Network. Next week will be issue 7, issue 5 never happened.